This episode of the Python Perspective is brought to you by The Naked Ape, Desmond Morris's bright, fact-packed, sensational bestseller, available at that lovely bookshop just across the road. I bet they've got a better selection and probably much, much lower prices than we do.
Who sent you?
The little old lady in the sweet shop.
She didn't have a dueling scar just here and a hook.
No,
of course not. I was thinking somebody else.
Welcome to the Python Perspective. Since its premiere in October 1969, Monty Python's Flying Circus has induced alienation and devotion, culminating in 2014 with what was announced as 10 final live performances in the 16,000-seat O2 Arena. On the 50th anniversary of each original television broadcast, we look back at the series and ask, what was innovative material then, what continues to be successful now, and what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me is my co-host Nathan, physicist, improv comedian, and actor.
Hello, Ben.
Hello, Nathan. It's a lovely, crisp 26th of October, 2019, 50 years after the original broadcast of Owl Stretching Time, which was recorded on the 21st of September. It's got filmed bits in it that were filmed in August and July earlier that year. It's a kind of an interesting combination of previously filmed segments and written segments that leads me to wonder how much of this was written as a unit and how much of it was assembled based on what they had available. We've talked a little bit in the previous episodes about the structure of the previous three shows, how the first two episodes started off with lots of little sketches and then ended with a curious mix of all of the writers and actors working together on a complicated multi-string segment, and that the third episode started with that multi-string segment and then ended with a bunch of sketches. This episode, on the other hand, has a completely different structure. It's got three strong, long sketches. We have the opening with the striptease sketch. That's 5 minutes and 10 seconds. We've got self-defense against fresh fruit. That's 6 minutes and 31 seconds. And then we have the secret agent dentists, which is 6 minutes and 30 seconds. So right there, that's basically 19 minutes. That's two-thirds of the episode is broken up into these three individual sketches. So really, this is a completely different organizational format than anything we've seen so far in Python. I don't know if you necessarily noticed that while you were watching it, but did you feel that this episode had a different tone or a different feel?
Yeah, I did. There are some odd callbacks, some weird recurrences of things which are not really significant to the sort of narrative of the entire episode, but they are things that come up again and again throughout the episode itself, which I think is new to their broadcast.
Yeah.
Things like, this is my only line.
This is my only line.
Aww. Gets said twice by two different people.
Yep. It's one of the recurring motifs.
The mention of the material gelignite.
Gave him a gelignite mouthwash.
I knew there was something.
Which is a jelly-like explosive, comes up twice. Spoken both by John Cleese as two very different characters.
Yeah, I sort of assumed that might be a precursor to, what's it called, plastic explosive? I do know that it's a gelatinized form of TNT and was invented by Alfred Nobel shortly after he invented dynamite.
Yeah, it's a very stable explosive that requires some kind of blasting cap or some kind of igniter. So you can basically stash it for long periods of time and then bring it out when you need it. But just the mention of that is just something that I noted.
Yeah.
There's a couple of times where people undress on a beach.
Wait, there's more than one?
Yeah, there's the royalty on the beach. He's undressing. He's not undressing down to his skivvies.
Oh, of course. I didn't even make the connection that his two servants the sedan chair.
There's also the bit on fruit. Of course, there's a self-defense against fresh fruit. But then there's the line.
I hear the gooseberries are doing well this year, and so are the mangoes.
So there are four separate items which are not really connected from sketch to sketch, but are brought up a couple of times. So I think those weird linkages are new to this episode.
I would say it rings not dissimilarly to the way in which the pigs are being killed. Is that in Wither Canada, the very first broadcast episode?
Right. Wither Canada definitely is the pig killing.
I will briefly mention that the existence of the fresh fruit is also in the montage that leads into the bookseller shop. There's a stock footage film of
drama, action, violence, fresh fruit, passion.
And the words fresh fruit are said over a close-up of some bouncing breasts, and the audience gets it with a quick giggle before it moves on and doesn't acknowledge that that's actually what they were doing. So actually three mentions of fresh fruit, if you include the oranges, mangoes, and the encyclopedia listing of all the different things that they've defended themselves against during self-defense against fresh fruit.
Lemons, plums,
yeah, and mangoes in syrup.
How about cherries?
We don't know them.
Red and black?
Yes.
I do think that you have the linkages, you have the common themes, you have that sense of material that's sprinkled in and out of the sketches, even if it's not deliberately linked to a gag. It's interesting that that happens a lot in an episode that is made up of three major sketches and then commonality of linking bits, because the links are also very prominent, that almost all of the links are done by Graham Chapman as the Sergeant Major.
Cut. Wait a minute. I've already warned this program about infringing the army.
Getting frustrated with the recurring use of the line, "It's a man's life," in the fill in the blank, which he considers to be the trademark of the Royal Army, although he himself can't actually say "it's a man's life" correctly the first time, but once says "it's a dog's life" and then "it's a pig's life" before correcting himself.
He is actually a colonel.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
The Sergeant Major is John Cleese in the Fresh Fruit.
Thank you. Okay, so a lot of those links happen directly after, as you mentioned, the Cardiff Room in Libya. The other common linking element is Eric Idle playing guitar and talking directly to camera as some sort of host.
Well, hello there again, ladies and gentlemen. This time we'd like to up the tempo.
It seems as if he's hosting some sort of call-in request show.
Pauline, Nigel, Tarquin, and old Spotty, Tarquin's mother.
Except he continues to just play Jerusalem over and over and over again. And progressively, as the series goes on, he is undressed and brought to bed by Katya Wyeth over the course of the thing. Very descriptive there, Russell.
Katya Wyeth, who is an actress model of the time. She was in the original Avengers, I believe, back in 1960, whatever. German-born. Funny how they got her.
She's quite good.
She's very good. But I'm wondering, was Carol Cleveland just not available? Or did they just want somebody different to... Maybe Carol was not willing to lick Eric Idle's face? Not sure.
Yeah, no, I found nothing that indicated as to why she was involved as opposed to Carol. Carol Cleveland, who does show up as the nurse alongside Dick Vosburgh's character of Vanderberg during the final dental secret agent bit. Although in the script, it's listed that the part would be played by Wyeth, which I find particularly interesting. Either it's a bad listing, although it's been in the All the Words Pantheon edition and the fully annotated All the Words, it resolutely says that the nurse is played by Wyeth because that seems to have been the original intention. Or they just assumed that she would be playing the girl in all the different parts in this episode. But for whatever reason, she's not. Again, we've mentioned this before. Sometimes I wonder if some of these things have to do with the practicality of costume changes. But Eric Idle seems to have been able to switch into his hat and mustache and coat in plenty of time to be able to get into the bookshop. I don't know whether it was more or less difficult for Ms. Wyeth to be able to get into her dental scrubs to accompany Dick Vosburgh and his machine gun.
I do not know.
Yeah, can only speculate. Well, we've gotten a little bit ahead of ourselves. We've talked about a number of different segments and some of the production. Let's zoom in. Nate, what is your favorite sketch of the episode?
Favorite sketch would be a self-defense against fresh fruit.
Oh, good. Now, I have mentioned on the website and alluded to in earlier episodes of the podcast that we, in high school, were some of those terrible, terrible people who did Monty Python skets at school assemblies. And I loved recreating those sketches in front of an audience. I loved getting other people's laughs for myself. It was thrilling. And I desperately wanted to do the self-defense against fresh fruit But I was talked down from doing self-defense against fresh fruit at the time. I'm not sure, based on a hazy memory of almost 25 years, whether or not this was because there were too many people in the sketch and it would have been difficult to accomplish, or it was the technical problems with dropping a 16-ton weight on somebody. Do you have any memory of saying that wasn't a good idea, or did you not think it was particularly funny at the time?
Thinking back, I would have said there are too many people. Because it was you, me, and our friend Mark, we were the three pushers of this whole idea. So we would have had to get two more people.
Five was hard. I was really looking forward to trying to figure out how to do the technical challenges of the 16-ton weight.
If anyone ever attacks you with a raspberry, simply pull the lever and the 16-ton weight...
The world will never know whether I would have hurt somebody or whether I would have gone on into a lucrative career in high school special effects if I'd been able to pull it off.
Well, bear in mind, the sketch on the show, it confines the viewing to the camera's frame, right? Mm. So it basically hovers maybe 1 or 2 feet above John Cleese. So you can have the 16-ton weight just out of frame and have the viewer not really notice. On a stage in our high school, you have a full... 30 feet, where you'd have to hide that thing up in the rafters.
Yeah.
And then be lining the drop to not crush or maim one of the high school actors. I don't think we would have gotten away with that.
There's a mention of the 16-ton weight in Daryl Larson's Guide to All the References, where he talks about the fact that there's no mention in the budget as to where the 16-ton weight comes from, but they did have to rebuild it for a later episode, and the next time that it appears, it's broken. You can see that when it drops on Michael Palin's presenter character in episode 12, so we'll probably talk about this in a few weeks, you can see that it shatters in the drop, and that they then have to submit a request to have it repaired in between the first and second seasons, which I think is pretty amusing. But also supports your point that there's a good chance we would have had something terrible befall us if we'd tried to do it. The camera ratio also lends itself to the fact that they're able to do the trickery with the tiger killing Eric Idle and, is it Michael Palin or Terry Jones?
Michael Palin and Eric Idle. Terry Jones was flattened by the 16-ton weight.
An ugly mob with raspberries is to release the tiger!
Got it. So yeah, when the last two survivors come at him and they release the tiger, that's all done with cleverly placed camera trickery to have them be dragged off stage by a clearly not very animated tiger on wheels.
This sketch was written to highlight John Cleese's strengths because he's just so crazy. And we've brought this up before on other episodes where that's the kind of the Cleese that we'd like to see.
Mm-hmm.
He's like a vein popping, angry all the time.
I'm now eating the banana! The deceased Mr. Apricot is now disarmed!
A great vocal humor. It's just like, he's so loud. In fact, I don't know how many times he had to do that take, but that I tried just doing it once in my living room and my voice hurt. So he has got a lot of vocal strength going on. Also, physically, the things that he's doing, some great physical comedy of lurching back and forth across the stage, acting like the military has embodied all of his joints and muscles that he jerks back and forth.
His physicality really is impressive. There is that sense that, you know, he's not noticeably taller than Graham Chapman, but at the same time, they're both quite elevated individuals, but he really fills out that t-shirt. And because he's walking around with a real physical presence and the rest of the characters are playing somebody slightly meeker, you do have this extraordinary physical difference between the five of them because of his performance. I will also point out that he definitely comes very close to losing his voice in the final moments of the scene, as he's screaming about how they're hiding under the floorboards with their
damsons and their prunes.
Right at the edge of absolutely losing his voice before the explosion goes off. So yeah, he's really turning it up to the proverbial 11 in order to tune in that performance.
Upon mention of the pineapple.
Yeah, you try that with a pineapple down your windpipe.
The pineapple?
Well.
He screams, where, and does this frenetic dance of about, a couple feet left and right. That is an amazing performance right there. Literally skating across the stage. So watching that and knowing that physical humor takes a lot of energy to do, he cranks it up. He goes into hyperdrive for that 1 or 2 seconds of showing sheer terror from the pineapple.
Which I'm glad you brought up, because it's my theory, which is mine, belonging to me, that this is the germ, the heart of the episode, is that it's all based on the fact that the classic American M2 fragmentation grenade had the nickname the pineapple. And I think that that's probably where this came from, is the idea of, you know, some piece of wartime dialogue of soldiers throwing pineapples at the enemy that then spun into the idea of, could a pineapple actually be something that someone was scared of, to the idea of therefore protecting yourself against a pineapple for real, and therefore all fruit is dangerous. There's nothing that leads me, there's no evidence for that except the slang. And the fact that pineapple shows up very vividly in this, try saying that with a pineapple stuffed down your throat, has a kind of visual meme. I can picture people with grenades in their mouths from various films and how dangerous that was as a threat. There's something there, and I can't prove it, but that's my current theory, which is mine.
So the sketch ends with the rant he gives to no one, but just people that he suspects are in the floorboards, yes, sneaking up on him with their prunes. And then he says,
I wire myself up to 200 tons of Jellignite!
So it's the first offer of Jellignite in the episode. And then he says, we'll both go up together. And I guess the idea is he blows himself up, because what happens is a very awkward flash and some styrofoam falling from the ceiling and some smoke, which is kind of comes before the cue. And then you have John Cleese looking very dissatisfied as the scene wipes up to the next cartoon segment. So I think that was showing the limitations of what they could do pyrotechnically.
And most of the explosions that we've seen previously in the series are on film. We have the explosions during the Deadliest Joke in the World. Those are all on film. They're not in the studio. Later, we'll have the exploding Blue Danube. Those will be done on film. This is an explosion that's taking place, as far as I can tell, in front of the studio audience. It doesn't look like it's done on a filter and laid in front of the footage. It looks like some kind of a flashbang, some kind of a flare paper that's used right there in front of an audience. So yeah, there obviously had to have been careful consideration of that particular aspect of the event, and therefore limitations as to what they could achieve.
Already in the show, they have smoke on stage, because there's the bit last episode with John Cleese reading the news. They have people break down a wall, fire fake guns while smoke is billowing in.
That's, yes,
the first bit of that is on set.
Correct.
And also, they've had Cleese and Palin pull guns. And also in this episode, Graham Chapman pull a gun on a dummy rabbit. They're shooting things on stage. And the trigger of the gun, of the prop, is actually affecting the blank explosion.
Right.
So they have active weapons on stage, which I don't think they'd be able to get away with today.
Yeah, I love the sketch. There's a lot that we could talk about with regard to the structure of it. I love the weirdness of the fact that he talks to the people in his class and forgets that their last name isn't a kind of fruit, that he calls Mr. Harrison Mr. Apricot.
You, Mr. Apricot!
Harrison.
Mr. Harrison, come with me!
And that Mr. Thompson is Mr. Tin Peach. He's obsessed with fruit in this very surreal and inexplicable way. I dearly love Eric Idle's desire to defend himself against a pointed stick, and the way he pronounces it every time.
Attacks you with a pointed stick.
In a pointed way, it always makes me laugh, as well as the instantaneous reaction from Cleese for him to just shut up is pretty great. Mm-hmm. And it is the largest laugh in the episode. There are a couple of very loud, explosive laughs in the show, but the one where Cleese shoots Graham's Mr. Harrison is clearly completely unexpected to both the characters and the audience, because there is an extraordinary long, prolonged laughter and applause at his shooting. They're not particularly worried about the fake guns going off in front of the audience and that kind of a special effect, but it was shocking enough that the audience laughed and applauded, and there's a long moment after that. I think in part merely to cover the fact that Cleese needs to get some banana down his pipe before he can go on to his next line.
Second sketch.
I'm really interested as to what you thought about the extended changing your clothes in public filmed bit starring Terry Jones. I've always found this sketch to be a little bit long. that it's pretty much one joke and that it didn't really, I didn't warm to it. And yet this, watching it this time, I found how much I enjoyed it. I really found it to be a very engaging, very sort of cheerful sketch, and not, it didn't bore me the way that it did when I was younger and more craven. And I'm interested as to what you thought about it.
I really love the silent film quality about it.
Okay.
They have only Foley sound effects. There's no dialogue. There's no audible talking of any kind. Mm-hmm. And they have slightly sped up the footage a little bit.
Yes.
So that does two things. It gets the movement, the running of Terry Jones as he's sprinting across the street to get away from people who are watching him to go faster. And it also makes the motion have a little more humor behind it. This is something we've talked about in previous episodes where sped up film footage lends itself to being more funny. Mm. Just like Buster Keaton used to do. So I like the fact that they did this whole thing without any words. Mm. They also make a really good use of the extras.
Okay.
So they probably took maybe a day or two to film.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a lot of people who I'm sure they didn't bus in from London who just happened to be there. So I guess still at this point, the show has not premiered. Now, they're filming in this late summer, so clearly it has not. So
yep.
People were just asked, do you want to be part of this? This is what it is. I thought that was great. They had people take away a stack of chairs in succession. And plus the two girls who grab the towel. I think it's a great use of extras. So that's really using what was available to them at the place.
Filmed in Bournemouth on the 10th of July. I agree with you specifically.
Bournemouth.
Particularly about the silent film quality is helped by the soundtrack. It's Colonel Bogey's March. Which was made famous, well, it was famous when it came out in 1915. It sold over a million copies of the sheet music, according to Wikipedia, but is largely known and often accidentally referred to as the Bridge Over the River Kwai March, because it featured prominently in that film when it came out in 1957. This recording, though, I believe is performed on a calliope. And so it has that merry-go-round, funfair quality to it, which I associate with the 20s, and therefore lends itself as well to reinforcing that silent film atmosphere.
It's a full 3.5 minutes when he walks down the steps to when he jumps into the theater. That's a long time to have no words. What do you do with a guy who has to but hates to undress in public, getting seen hiding behind a car, hiding behind a towel? Hiding behind a...
It's called a Nickelodeon. It was a kind of animation thing where you would actually have each frame on a still card and it would flip through them, therefore creating the illusion of movement. You'd put a nickel in, then it would play itself through, uh-huh. Which is how the name came to be called that. There are people who say, in the history of media, the second we're able to create a new way of recording anything, we put naked people on it. And very early on in photography, we had stop motion films of people taking their clothes off or people jumping in the nude. Not dissimilar to that, the What the Butler Saw Nickelodeon would have people put in a nickel and watch somebody strip. It is a legitimate piece of history that it wouldn't have been at all surprising to see a man taking his trousers down in a little low rent movie on the seaside.
So then he jumps into the theater.
So we've had about 3 minutes up to this point of mostly silent and mostly underscored by Colonel Bogey's March. And then we have blackness and silence until a curtain comes up and we see that he's in front of an audience. And he gives up and starts to embrace the fact that he has to take his clothes off in public. And a piece of music that's literally called The Stripper comes on. It's the most famous, most recognizable piece of burlesque music that was composed by a film composer named David Rose for a television movie that was a recreation of a play called Burlesque. And in a 1964 interview, he said that he had never been used for anything until it was put on as a B-side. And then instantly it became the thing that everybody uses as... If you're going to take your clothes off, this is the wah, 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 wah noise that you do it to. And then we have a solid 2 minutes of Terry Jones doing the full striptease to this. After 3 minutes of silent film acting, do you think that that's a good use of the audience's time to not cut away, but to have him do the full Monty, as it were?
No, I don't think so.
Interesting.
It's a task. So a couple things change. It's now done at 1x speed, so it seems much more human. Mm. They have only 2 camera cuts.
Correct.
So maybe they only had time to do it at most twice. He's doing it on some set, which was probably there. So they probably got permission to film in some theater, which can only give them 1 or 2 hours. So they had to pack in maybe 5 or 6 extras to make it look like the theater was full. To me, it's not very enjoyable to watch Terry Jones do a striptease. 2 minutes, kind of, to me, goes on too long.
So even the essential comic inversion of this is not the sort of person that you'd want to see take his clothes off. No offense, Mr. Jones, but that he is finally embracing it and doing the whole walking up his calf with the fingers in order to take his socks off. All the little playful tricks that are part of the ordinary burlesque tradition. The fact that it's being done by this slightly round, mustached man doesn't make you laugh at the reversal of fortune.
It does not. If you listen to the laugh track that's there,
yeah,
it's clear the audience is a little put off by it, is kind of what I come away with. It's like, yeah, I think it's funny, but I'm not really finding it as rip-roaring laughter-inducing as other parts. My sense is, if they had sped it up, it may have gotten a bigger laugh.
Interesting.
I don't find the inversion of him going from feeling very awkward about getting down even to his underwear, still keeping his top on to change into his swim trunks, and then all of a sudden flipping that so that he's stripping in front of a live audience. I don't really find that funny.
I like the fact that there's something about the sped up quality that we talked about this last week when we talked about Bicycle Repairman, and you alluded to it earlier this episode, that there's something about the sped up motion of humanity that we find inherently amusing. And that's part of the charm of this sketch for you is the choreography, particularly with the taking of the chairs away, that he's actually slowing down with that in order to have the timing of him taking his pants down be exactly with the movement of the disappearance of the chairs. That there's a lot of physical choreography going along in order for the sped up film to work. That goes away,
yeah,
and some of the humor goes away with it in your eyes. I think it's an interesting observation. Nathan, what's the third most successful sketch in the show?
It's A Dog's Life in the Modern Army.
Okay.
The reappearance of the colonel I do find to be really enjoyable. It's a new way that the Pythons have found to artificially end sketches.
Yes.
But I heard that. I'm going to stop this sketch now. And if there's any more...
Rather than have it just blow up with some cartoon or some odd particular segue... First time we see a recurring character within an episode that has a point to make, and that point is made 4 times throughout the episode. He says, you're using the line from the army and you're using it wrong.
That's copyrighted. We aren't going to put up with your sloppy, long-haired civilian plagiarism.
So I enjoy the newness of that, and that it's not just Terry Gilliam coming in with some cartoon. They're revisiting the idea of stopping their own sketches, but now they're just doing it in a more interesting way. Not a more interesting way, but a different way, which is also interesting. And I do like Graham Chapman as this role.
Mm.
Kind of hardline leading man, a little buffoonish. He plays that buffoonery really well.
I do want to defend Gilliam a little bit in this episode in that we've mentioned the sedan chair and the person who has his clothes taken off bit by bit so that he can go bathing. Some sort of 18th century nobility. We're not quite sure. He looks French to me, but that I wasn't able to do any or find any sources that indicated it, whether or not he was supposed to be a specific person or a specific type of person. Regardless, the link to that filmed bit, which was also filmed in the summer previous to the episode, was shot in 21st August in 69. So they had plenty of time for Gilliam to do the link. And the link is extraordinary. He literally has a cutout of the two men carrying the palanquin, and then it's positioned on the frame where it can then cut to the film bit almost seamlessly, where it starts off as an animated element and then it becomes a live filmed segment. That's a level of technical transition that the show hadn't yet achieved by this point. You know, you've had a couple instances of Gilliam showing up on camera, his hands affecting things, but by and large, there hasn't been a direct interaction between the animated segments and the filmed or taped segments. And this is the first, and I love it. It's really good.
It is really good. Timing, the placement in the frame, even the which step they're on,
yep,
it's hard to find fault in there.
All that said, Graham Chapman is hilarious as the colonel. And it is a lovely part that comes back again and again, and a fan favorite during the live shows that people would whoop and cheer when he would walk out and say, "Stop that.
Silly."
I am interested that the extended final segment of the Secret Service dentists didn't make it. There are three big sketches in the episode, and of your top three, you have two of them and the linking segments. So there must have been something about the Secret Service dentist that didn't work for you. I think the beginning is fascinating because the colonel says...
I thought it was supposed to be about teeth anyway. Why can't you do something about teeth?
You said that the show was going to be about teeth. Well, let's have something about teeth. And then we have the aforementioned clip show of the trailer for books. We cut to a bookshop and then we have a solid 2 minutes and 43 seconds until teeth come up in conversation. So for a good period of the sketch, I'd forgotten this. I'd forgotten what this sketch was. I'm watching that saying, the colonel told me this is going to be about teeth. They're not talking about teeth. When are the teeth going to come into it? So when Arthur Lemming eventually says,
I'd like to buy a copy of An Illustrated History of False Teeth.
And Cleese's character changes, that's a real dramatic turn. And I did spend those previous 2 minutes, 43 seconds enjoying the tension of wondering when it was going to be about teeth. I think the sketch then changes several times in tone before it reaches its conclusion. But that opening is so good. I mention it only because you've mentioned previously that you really like sketches that have all of the players in it. And obviously Self-Defense Against Fresh Fruit had that. Mm-hmm. But it didn't feel like a skit that was written by all of them. Whereas this is a sketch that very clearly has so many people in it that you need to have Dick Vosburgh come in as the extra American crime lord, and you need to have Carol Cleveland as the mostly silent nurse. There is a strong sense that this is a sketch that feels like bits of it were added in by the different writers. And so it's interesting that that has been a hallmark of something you've enjoyed in the past and then didn't work for you this time.
It feels to me like it's other sketches cobbled together, other sketches which chronologically will not have come out at this point.
Okay.
But it feels like, okay, this is the bookshop sketch when he's here to buy books. But then all of a sudden, John Cleese doesn't want to sell him anything.
Good morning. I'd like to buy a book, please.
Well, I'm afraid we don't have any.
So in that way, it's also a precursor to the cheese shop sketch in that it's the person trying to buy something, but nothing's available. I think that's a very perceptive argument that this sketch is comprised of elements that they themselves would revisit to better success later. And it gives you an idea that there's the roots of something here, but that it's not entirely successful, and that they themselves would therefore consciously or unconsciously say, let's go back and take some of the work that was there and see if we can fix it again.
I do like how Chair Jones comes out with a anti-tank bazooka. A weapon where if he pulled the trigger, everyone in the room would die.
Including him.
Including him. That he just can't really.
Yeah, he doesn't really want to do it.
I've forgotten what I'm here to do.
Right.
I don't know if this is a mistake in writing, but at the top of the sketch, John Cleese wants to push off the meeting and go to lunch. Oh, look, it's like it's only 10:30. And then 2 minutes later, at the end of the sketch, it's 1:00, time for lunch.
Nathan, that bugs me so much. That really bugs me. I gotta tell you, it's one of the reasons I sort of want to make sure that we talked about this. That fact that 5 minutes and 35 seconds later, it's gone from 10:30 to 1:00 drives me crazy. Ugh. The fact that that's the way in which they wrap up the skit should be ordinary absurdity. And there's an interesting audience response there because I'm obsessed with audience response. There's weak applause when he says, let's all cut for lunch. The audience tries to get an applause break going and fails, which is just marvelous. But yeah, the unreality of how much time has passed drives me berserk. If you're going to have animations, if you're going to have colonels who break the scene, if you're going to have all these tricks that allow you to end a scene without having a good joke, and then you do that instead? I don't get it. The Daryl Larson entry on that particular aspect says that they felt that it was a reference to the Looney Tunes cartoons where the sheepdog and the wolf would clock in and talk about how, you know, good morning, Ralph. Good morning, Sam. And they'd be off duty and they'd be sort of not worried about killing each other. And then they'd fight once they clocked in. I don't agree with that reference. It's a nice allusion, but I don't agree with it as a reference. I just think it's bad writing and they let it go anyway. Now it comes the time in this episode, as it comes in every episode, where we have the Monty Python Minute, the minor satirical take on those podcasts that break down great works of fiction and creativity minute by minute in order to hyperanalyze and overanalyze the minute seconds of the composition and work. We do not have enough time to do that, so instead we squanch in a single minute randomly generated and chosen by random.org of the episode of which we're speaking. And Nathan has 30 seconds to summarize what takes place in those 60 seconds, and then an additional 90 seconds in which to tell us what jumped out at him, what was important, and why that minute would possibly be deserving of a whole podcast episode on somebody else's podcast. Are you ready, Nathan?
Never.
All right. Our randomly number-generated moment from Monty Python's fourth episode, Owl Stretching Time, is minute 13. That number again for listeners at home, minute 13.
Yeah, you, take this. Now it's quite simple to defend yourself against
All right, Nathan, your 30 seconds begins now.
This is the middle of the How to Defend Yourself Against Fresh Fruit sketch, where John Cleese, as a sergeant major, offers up a banana to Graham Chapman, who he misidentifies as Mr. Apricot, but he's really Mr. Harrison. And he's telling him, come out and threaten me, brandish that banana as vicious as you like. And he can't
10 seconds
do it.
Left.
He's like kind of walking like, and then eventually he resets and screams and runs after the police, who shoots him. Then he eats the banana. And they all said, you ate the banana. You killed him. You shot him dead. So I was just like, he's attacking me with the banana.
Stop. All right. You have a minute and a half to tell us about this aspect of the scene.
So as we've talked about before about this sketch, John Cleese plays a very hypernetic character. I just made that word up, but he is doing his greatest performances on the show, which are him just being super over the top crazy. And he plays a sergeant major in the military trying to tell these four saps how to defend themselves against fresh fruit laden assailants. And so what you see is a lot of verbal energy and darting back and forth of Cleese, contrasted with the much more sedate performance of Chapman, by design to just be a student in this class of defending yourself against fresh fruit. And Graham Chapman comes up to Cleese bearing the banana, and he gets basically told you have to do it more aggressively, so... we're basically, what are we doing? We're ratcheting up the tension in the scene. And then finally, Cleese just grabs a gun and shoots him, which is not a great way to defend yourself against somebody if you do not have a gun. And all the other people are like, you just shot him dead. It's like, oh, he was attacking me with a banana. Why this is important? It's some good portrayal of Cleese's ability. And it seems like this is a sketch that's written mainly for him.
5 seconds.
And the others are there to support him. And that's it. That there's no 1610 weight yet. There's no tiger yet. But it is. It's some good physical and verbal comedy from Cleese himself.
I'm interested that you focused mostly on Cleese.
I was repeating a lot of what was said already. So
well, then let's concentrate a little bit on Chapman's performance, because there are two aspects of this particular sketch that I love. One of which is the way in which Cleese gestures as to how somebody would attack them with fresh fruit. He does it with two different kinds of fruit. First of all, when he starts talking about today, we're going to start with, and then later when he gives the baskets of, is it Loganberries? To Palin and to Idle. He says, come at me with them. And he does this strange gesture where he goes down at hip level.
Raspberries.
He comes at hip level, thrusting forward the kind of way in which you would anticipate that somebody might grab you in the groin. There's this very strange aspect to it, that would be the way in which you would attack somebody with fruit, is to sort of get them in the nethers, the way in which you would with a cream pie if you were not hitting them in the face. Whereas that's not what Chapman does when he's attacking him with a banana. At first, he's just walking out with the banana. But then he raises it above him like it's a knife, like he's going to stab somebody with the banana. It's the natural shape of the banana, is to turn it into a bladed object. As ludicrous as that sounds, considering that a banana is, as we all know, squishy and would not penetrate skin. And so I do love Graham Chapman's transformation as somebody who's so frustrated that he goes from just ambling forward with the banana out in front of him to then somebody who freaks out and probably would try to kill Cleese with this banana if a banana was as dangerous as the Sergeant Major believes it to be.
Yeah, you try to do that in 90 seconds.
All right, fair point. I don't know how long that was for me, but you're absolutely correct in that I did not take a mere... I've never said anything in 90 seconds that I couldn't say in 5 minutes. So you're right.
So now's the part of the show where we're going to mention our top favorite moments in the episode. A moment, just to repeat, is not a full sketch, is not a full anything. It's just a moment, a brief few seconds of tape, of film, of cartoon, of minor performance on the screen that just makes us laugh and giggle. Ben, give me a top five moment.
Nathan, I only need one moment. It's my only moment. This is my only line. I love this bit so much.
But it's my only line.
All right.
So marvelous. They do it twice in this episode. Katya Wyeth's delivery of it is precious. Her sad whining and bursting into tears when Palin criticizes her for saying it.
I mean, have to say, you could have kept quiet for a change. No. Oh, that's typical. Don't.
It's lovely. And Gilliam's facial expression when he has to do it in the Viking costume and everyone's jeering at him. He's like, but it's my only line. He's so sad. Oh, both of their performances of that only line moment kill me. They are so good.
So can I ask you then, is it for Katya Wyeth's part?
Yes.
Does that include the actual joke that she says?
What, oh dear?
What a terrible joke.
So, interesting reflection on that. The audience doesn't laugh. I've read a piece of commentary from when the Onion AV Club did their recaps on Monty Python's Flying Circus in 2012. Zach Handlin said that he believed that this was because it got lost in the laughter to Palin's previous line. But I think, like me, people didn't necessarily know that Watteau was an artist. I don't think he's a common enough name that he works alongside the other references to the other scenes that have preceded it. I think it's an obscure joke. Mm-hmm. And the only reason you know that she has in fact made a joke is because of her self-satisfied smile and Palin's utter disgust at that joke and telling us that she shouldn't have made it in the first place. She should have had better taste than to try and deliver that line. Otherwise, I wouldn't have known it. I wouldn't have mm-hmm. known what was going on. So I think her line delivery on Watteau is also lovely, but it's her absolute depression at the fact that Palin thought she shouldn't have even said it that is just wonderful.
Talk, 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 nag, 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 nag.
What about you? What's in your top five moments?
Royalty on the beach.
Oh, good.
This has come up already in this episode. A small bit about some kind of European royalty, maybe French, maybe English. It is, I believe, Eric Idle as the royalty and his two subordinates, Palin and Jones. And when they bring him to the seaside and he walks out and they start to undress him, it's sped up. As we mentioned, also it adds a little bit more humor to the scene. But the moment that I like the most is the absolutely perfect to the millisecond physicality of Eric Idle, where he takes one step forward with his cane, takes a big inhale, and about face goes back into the cart and they push him into the ocean. That timing is so good. It is so good. Even sped up, it is still perfect. Really good physical comedy.
Fantastic. I'm going to come in with number three, going back a little bit before the moment that I chose previously, when we have the two women in the art gallery talking about their obnoxious children, Ralph and Kevin. There's this repeated bit where they are slapping and disciplining their children off camera. First of all, I want to know what it is they're slapping. It makes a great noise, and I'm pretty sure it's not dubbed in afterwards. There's something off camera, just to the right or left of the camera, that they are whacking with their hand, and it makes a great slapping noise, and I wish I knew what it was. But there's this marvelous little bit where Chapman goes off camera for a second to discipline her child and is slapping him repeatedly.
You're a naughty, naughty, vicious little boy! Oh, look at that!
And so Cleese looks at her own child and then just gives him a good one just because he hasn't slapped him in a moment and all this other slapping is going on. And it's just this weird little piece of corporal punishment cruelty that makes me laugh.
I'm so glad you brought that up because I had exactly the same moment on my list of best moments.
Oh, good. It's pretty funny. It's just this offhand casual cruelty, and Cleese delivers it in a note-perfect manner.
I want to say it's some kind of big solid stone because there's no resonance. It's just like a hard like tap.
Yeah.
There's no gong. There's no like softness to it. I want to say it's just a big, maybe a big ball of marble.
I like it. There's this off-screen bollard standing there.
Okay, so that means then that I only have one more that I can bring because you have ticked off actually two already.
Haha, moment thief. That's me.
So I'm going to bring in John's rustic monologue.
Oh, good.
This is a lead into the colonel breaking up the sketch. You're stealing our man's life motto from the military. But it's a short, probably under a minute, I didn't time it, of John Cleese in some kind of accent.
Yes, you know, it's a man's life in England's mountains green.
What? I heard that. I heard that. I'm going to stop this. And
the line, which I just think is totally inappropriate for a character like that.
I'm not sleeping with that producer again.
Yeah, it's sort of the reedy intellectual version of Graham Chapman's Northern Farmer episode from The Sheep Flying. He's clearly doing their version of what rustic England sounds like. And yeah, it's a very, very strange impression, and he's hilarious at it.
Okay, man, bring us home with number five.
Nathan, there is a rule of three in comedy that we're all familiar with, and yet this episode brought us four instances of the Colonel. I believe it only had three instances of Eric Idle as playing the guitar, but it had five pointhead sticks.
You promise you tell us about pointhead sticks?
Shut up! Eric Idle says pointhead stick and gets slapped down five times. And by God, I loved every single one of them. Screw you, rule of three. Five pointhead sticks is now what I'm singing when I sing the 12 Days of Christmas. And it deserves recognition.
Indeed. This episode of The Python Perspective was conceived, researched, and performed by Ben Russell and Nathan Emily. Sound design also by the two of us.
The theme song is by John Philip Sousa and was sourced by Creative Commons clips from the archive.org community.
Editing was done by me, Nathan. You can find us at pythonperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at PythonPod. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of the comic phenomenon known as Monty Python's Flying Circus.
There are things, dates, facts, names, potatoes, data of any kind that you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via the website. We'll post it to our errata page on pythonperspective.com as soon as possible.
And once again, our discussion, jabs at each other, otherwise verbal abuse, is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Nathan. My co-host is Ben.
That's Mr. Blackberry to you.
We'll see you next time when we discussed episode 5, Man's Crisis of Identity in the Latter Half of the 20th Century. Then I'll probably cut away to me just being like, who am I?
Right, right. That's what it lends itself to.
1980s music and 1990s music. Who knows?